Hey, good morning, everybody. Welcome to Bio 231, Human Anatomy, November 30th. So we've got 2 weeks of school left. Actually, there's only 3 lectures because that last period, there is your final exam. All right, so let's take a look at the schedule, November 30th. We're almost done with digestive system, so we'll probably get into urinary system today, which is a good thing. And then we'll have Wednesday and next Monday to talk about that diversification system. And that's the chapter that everybody has stayed in this class to learn about. So we're getting to the end. All right, so what are the chapters on the last test, which is on December 9th? It's going to be 19 all the way through 25. Some of those chapters are really short, like lymphatic system. Probably only take you a couple minutes to read through that one. All right, but everything that you need to know is in the study guides. The Wednesday lab group is welcome to take the practicum on Wednesday during their regular time, either before the practicum before the final exam or after the final exam, but they're also welcome to take it on Monday morning or Monday afternoon. And maybe you should let me know. I think we're going to have room for everybody. And for those of you that are taking the practicum on Monday morning, we're going to start at 9 o'clock instead of 8 o'clock because it's not going to take a lot of time. It's not going to take 3 hours to complete the practicum, right? And probably the same thing for the Wednesday lab group in the morning. But I'll be here at the same time, usual time, so I can open up that study room for you. All right, so, and you can just go in there and study. Can't study in the classroom, but in that study room, you're welcome to do that. All right, so we were talking about digestive system last time, and we noticed that there were a number of secretions by various organs, and here's a list of secretions. Right, 1.5 liters of saliva is produced every day, gastric juice 2.5 liters every single day, and that fluid has to come from your body someplace. That fluid loss produces dehydration and electrolyte loss. That can be a serious issue. All right, so from the pyloric sphincter up, we lose 4 liters, and from that pyloric sphincter, which is right at the end of the stomach, we lose an additional 4 liters. Intestines, small intestines secrete 3 liters of fluid into the small intestine. That's a huge volume, right? And even the liver and pancreas secrete about one liter of fluid into the small intestine. So all total, it's 8 liters. That's a huge amount of fluid to lose from your body. And we're going to see how it is that you can actually live through this kind of ordeal. All right, so let me write that real, really dark. 8 liters. And just remember, the amount of blood that you have in your body is only 5 liters. So we're losing more than the volume of blood that we have. That's pretty amazing. Leave that on, that off. Okay, so we got down pretty much to the large intestine last time. And that's where I'm going to start off, unless somebody has a question on the schedule. Anybody have a question regarding the schedule? Not too bad. Okay. Digestive system. All right, so we got down to the large intestine. But you know what? There is something I want to review because it is so important before we get to the large intestine, and it has to do with the small intestine. So you see the slide on the right. It's a nice illustration of the small intestine. And the small intestine is a tube, right? But it's not a straight, flat tube because there are all kinds of wrinkles on the inside of it. There are what we call circular folds or plicae circulari. And think of a straight tube, and if you compress the ends, it's going to fold up someplace. And these are the folds that would result from that. So if you press the ends of a tube together to make it shorter, right, then you're going to get these folds right here, which we call plicae circularis. Then on each of those folds, there are some additional folds. These are actually like papillae or fingertips sticking up off of the plicae circularis. These are what we call villi. And here is a villus. And so these are actually acting like folds, the plicae circularis. They increase the surface area for absorption as well. And if you look at each of these columnar cells, like is shown over here on the right, even the apical surface of all of these cells has some additional folds. We call these microvilli. And I think you learned what the function of microvilli were way back when we were starting to talk about organelles inside of a cell. Probably didn't make much sense back then, but now you know that microvilli are important for, in one word, absorption, right? Because the width of this cell right here is not from here to here, right? If we need to measure it when all of these microvilli are flat, so we need to stretch the cell out from right to left to straighten all of these microvilli out, and you'll see that this cell is much, much wider than it's portrayed here when the microvilli are drawn in. All right, so those are three important structures that increase absorption, or the surface area for absorption in the small intestine. So I tell you what, you guys should just verbalize it to me. What are those three structures that modify the small intestine to increase absorption? Circular folds, number one. Villi, number two. And microvilli, number three. Right? So just think, if you're going to make that small intestine a straight tube, you'd have to flatten out all of those folds, and then you'd really see how long a tube that is. And as a matter of fact, I think I have it in your notes. All right, small intestine. If it was a simple straight tube, the surface area would be 3.5 square feet. But if you take into account all of the plicae circularis, all the villi and microvilli, all those folds, right, then its surface area would increase to 2,200 square feet. That's huge. Right, that's much bigger than a tennis court. That is the floor area of a two-level house. So both floors added together. Right, and then the other thing that I want you to remember is when I say surface area, what's the everyday word that you should be thinking of? A doorway. That's right, because we measured the surface area of that doorway, and if we were to increase the surface of it, area of that doorway, then more students could go back and forth through that doorway. Right, so absorption is directly related to surface area. If one increases, the other one increases as well. Okay, so that's a really important point. All right, so let's move on to large intestine. Large intestine, let's look at some anatomy of it first. All right, so the small intestine has those three divisions, the duodenum close to the stomach, the jejunum in the middle, and the ileum is the most distal part of the small intestine, and that's the part that connects up to the large intestine. Here is the large intestine, and this is the very last piece of the ileum, or small intestine, and it empties into a part of the large intestine we call the cecum. So this whole area here is the cecum. There is a strong circular smooth muscle, which is a sphincter, or you can consider it a valve, that regulates the flow of material from the small intestine into the large intestine. So when the small intestine is done doing its job, then it allows that material to move into the large intestine so that it can perform its function on that material. The other parts of the large intestine, here is the ascending colon. Here's the transverse colon, descending colon, and this little squiggly part right here, that's called the sigmoid colon. And what you can't see on this diagram, it also courses a bit inferiorly. And then we have the rectum and anal canal, and there are some sphincters in this region. External anal sphincter, and there's an internal anal sphincter. One is under voluntary control, the other is involuntary control. So that's some of the features of the large intestine, including the appendix. The cecum in some animals is large. The cecum can be even larger or longer than the large intestine itself. And that's important for animals that need to digest bulk material like cellulose, grasses, and things of that nature. The cecum is important. We don't have that in our diet. So we don't need a functional cecum, and what happened to that organ is that it has shrunk down, and what remains is just lymphatic tissue in something that we call the appendix, right? And that lymphatic tissue you find throughout the intestinal tract in the form of malt, and that lymphatic tissue makes sure that bacteria that are in our digestive tract don't have gain entry into our body. And even more importantly, there are beneficial bacteria in the large intestine that produce vitamins for us. And then there are pathologic kinds of bacteria. So it's the job of that lymphatic system to promote the health of the normal microbiota that produce vitamins for us, but yet contain and control the pathogenic kinds of material or bacteria. So that's what the appendix is for, and all of the lymphatic tissue associated with the large intestine. These bends, these 90-degree bends, usually we call a ramus in anatomy, but for the large intestine, we're going to call it a flexure. And there's different ways that we can talk about this flexure, because the one on the right over here is very close to the liver. We call this the hepatic flexure. And you could call it the right colic flexure if you wanted to. Either one will work. Here is, if this is the right one, here's the left one, the left colic flexure, and it's close to the spleen. Remember, the spleen is kind of tucked underneath the stomach and maybe a little bit behind the stomach. That's where you find this flexure, so sometimes it's called the splenic flexure. And everybody knows the terminology that these things are the same. All right, some other things about the large intestine. These are pockets, and one is called a haustrum. All of them together are haustra, and they're there to help the large intestine do its job, which we haven't talked about just yet. We're going to get to that really soon. There are circular smooth muscles in the large intestine, and this tinea coli, this ridge right here, is connective tissue that those smooth muscles insert onto to perform their particular function. Right, so that's like the insertion of those smooth muscles. And then we have some of these nodules of lipid, and we call these epiploic appendages, and I don't think anybody has the slightest idea why they're there, but they probably perform some kind of function. We're just not exactly sure what it is. All right, so that is the anatomy of the large intestine. So what is the function? Okay, the function, surprisingly, is no digestion. And that's surprising because this is part of your digestive tract, right? All the digestion should take place in the small intestine. And that's where nutrients are absorbed as well. Nutrients are absorbed, materials are digested in the small intestine. And it should be completely. So no nutrients ever enter the large intestine. So there's no digestion taking place because there's nothing to digest. And number two, the job of the large intestine is to resorb all of that water that was secreted into the digestive tract before it got to the large intestine. And what was that amount of water? 1.5 of saliva, 2.5 of gastric juice, 3 liters of intestinal juice, and an additional liter from the liver. Right, in the form of bile and other kinds of compounds. So that's 8 liters. So the job of the large intestine is to resorb those 8 liters of fluid and electrolytes so that you do not dehydrate. 8 liters is a huge amount of volume, and we dehydrate very rapidly if we didn't resorb that water. When the digested material from the small intestine enters the large intestine and water is removed from it, what remains is feces. And so some people say that the function of the large intestine is to produce feces, and that is true, but the process of producing feces is what? Resorption of water. That's the most important thing, and electrolytes. Okay. The bacteria, the normal bacteria, produce vitamin K for us. Vitamin K is an important blood clotting factor. So without vitamin K, we have very poor blood clotting function, and anytime we would have a hemorrhage, it would be a major hemorrhage if our blood would not clot. So that's very dangerous. All right, when I look at the large intestine right here, I recall that it's prone to cancer in some people, especially if you have family history of it. And in the United States, there's 40 to 50,000 people dying of large intestine cancer or colon cancer every year. That's a huge number, and that's really sad that that happens. Right? There's about 200,000 new cases every year that are discovered, And the reason why that's really sad, all those people die, is because colon cancer is easily detectable. And it's a slow-growing tumor in most cases. So if it's easily detectable and it's slow-growing, when you detect it early, then the procedures that are used are curative. Right? So nobody really has to die of colon cancer under certain kinds of conditions. Maybe some will. Right? But in general, it's a shame that it happens. And the way that it's diagnosed easily is with a video camera. So a video camera is inserted with, along with some tools, into the sigmoid colon. And with that video camera, if a operator notices some suspicious tissue, with a scissors they can snip it off, bring it out, and have it analyzed by a histologist to find out if it's precancer, normal tissue, or cancerous tissue. And then make some decisions going from there based on what layers are involved. Right, so that's why layers are important. You should know all the layers of the digestive tract. Right, what kind of treatment is necessary? So the precancerous lesions inside the large intestine almost look like these epiploic appendages, but they're not lipid. Right, they're actual tissues, mucosa, submucosa of the large intestine. And to prevent bleeding, right, then those, they're called polyps. When their polyps are removed, they're cauterized. Right, so they're cut off, cauterized, so that they don't bleed. Right, so sigmoidoscopy is one exam. The other is a colonoscopy. The colonoscopy is more extensive. It goes all the way up to the splenic flexure. And it's a much better exam. It investigates more of the large intestine. And if you're ever given a choice between a sigmoidoscopy and a colonoscopy, guess what you should ask for? A colonoscopy, because many times after a sigmoidoscopy, somebody's going to say, oh, we have some ambiguous results and you have to come back for a colonoscopy. But if you had that done the first time, then you don't have to come back. It's not a terribly painful procedure, but what is really obnoxious is that you have to prepare yourself for the exam, right? There can't be any feces in the large intestine. And maybe if you fast for a week, all that material would be gone. But there are other ways that it is removed from your body, and your physician will prescribe whatever method they like. Okay? One method is by drinking something that's called Go Lightly. All right? And it's a whole gallon. And the first couple glasses don't taste too bad, but after that, every time you drink some, you probably feel like vomiting. Right? So you get really tired of drinking that whole gallon. And you might not want to drink that whole gallon. And say you drink 3/4 of that gallon, and you go and get the exam, right, and you're all prepped, and the physician enters and says, oh, you're not prepped properly, I can't see well enough, you have to go home. And next week, you have to drink a whole gallon, right, instead of 3/4 of a gallon. So now what have you drunk? Instead of 1 gallon, you've drunk 1 3/4 gallon, so it's best just to do it right the first time, right, so you don't have to repeat that part of the procedure. The other thing, the solution is called Go Lightly, and that's kind of a really nasty misnomer because the last thing you're going to do is go lightly. All right? You're going to have copious amounts of watery stool, washing, cleansing the large intestine out, and the lightly part is not because it's heavy or light, it's not because it's on the light end of heavy, it's because it's a special mixture of electrolytes. It's L-Y-T-E, like in Pedialyte. Because we can't just drink a gallon of water and expect our water balance and electrolyte balance to stay within normal limits in our body. Right? Other physicians might actually have you take other kinds of medication to clean the large intestine, but Go Lightly is pretty much the standard procedure. Okay, so preparation for that exam is key. Just do it 100% correctly the first time, then you don't have to reschedule and do it over again. All right, and the colonoscopy is much, much better. All right. So we said the job of the small intestine is to absorb nutrients. If the small intestine can't do its job, then we have nutrients entering the large intestine. And who is in the large intestine that will gratefully accept all those nutrients and use them to their benefit? All those bacteria, right? The beneficial bacteria, harmful bacteria will be stimulated into growing, right? They will proliferate, they will irritate the large intestine, increase the motility of the large intestine, so that it can't absorb all of that water because the material is moving too rapidly through the large intestine. Right? And that produces copious amounts of watery stool, which commonly we call diarrhea. Right? All right, so if there are nutrients that enter the large intestine, it produces that malabsorption syndrome characterized by severe diarrhea. And when that happens, what do you think might happen to your water balance? Does it go out of whack? Do you become dehydrated, or do you stay normal? You become dehydrated. Exactly right. So that's a serious condition, probably not for somebody our age, but it certainly is for infants and the elderly. And as a matter of fact, if you just look at the World Health Organization, more people die of dehydration as a result of diarrhea than any other cause. And people get diarrhea because they drink unclean water, unsanitary water. That's pretty amazing. Okay. All right, so that is the large intestine. And if you have family history of colon cancer, rectal cancer, then you're at a high priority for getting that colonoscopy done. And for sure, don't put it off because it can save your life, right? Because if caught early, it is completely curable, which is really, really nice. All right, so that's the function of the large intestine. And that just kind of leaves us with the liver. You know, the liver is on the right-hand side of the body, pretty big organ, right? Large organ right here. And you know that its function is to produce a detergent that we call bile. And bile emulsifies lipids so that they can dissolve in water. And here is the bile duct system. You have to draw that in lab with this figure in mind. So the liver produces bile. It also stores in itself, it doesn't ship it out to any other place for storage, it stores glycogen. And glycogen is an important product, right, because it's the building block is sugar. The building block is glucose. So when your blood glucose starts to decrease, the liver has the necessary enzymes to break down glycogen and put that glucose into your blood so that your cells don't starve. Then that's the only organ in your body where that will happen. So glycogen, the way you should think of glycogen is that it's an animal product and it's very much like starch, which is a plant product. Starch and glycogen are almost the same kind of thing. The basic building block for both is glucose, sugar. Right? Also in the liver, not only does it store sugar in the form of glycogen, but it stores some vitamins like vitamin A, B12, D, E, K. And mostly these are fat-soluble vitamins, right? And they can be stored. And since they're fat-soluble and stay in your body, you can actually overdose on some of these vitamins. Unlike water-soluble vitamins, right, like vitamin C, it's almost impossible because if you take too much, you just urinate it right out of your body. Not so for fat-soluble vitamins. And the liver can store some important metals like copper and iron. And iron is important for making functioning red blood cells because it's necessary to make hemoglobin. And so the liver is very important for maintaining the health of your blood. The liver can also interconvert various metabolites so that your body stays in balance. It can take a precursor of vitamin D and convert it into a more active form of vitamin D. And does anybody know what vitamin D is good for? Well, there's probably all kinds of things that we're learning about it, but the first thing is necessary for calcium absorption, right? And you need calcium in your body. What do you need calcium in your body for? Bones is one. Muscle contraction is another. Synaptic transmission, right, is the third. So you need proper levels of calcium, and probably the most important, well, they're all pretty important, but probably the most important is what? Synaptic transmission, allowing nerve cells to be able to communicate with each other. And vitamin D is necessary for that. The liver can also convert fat into phospholipids. Anybody remember what a phospholipid is good for? What's a phospholipid good for? It's the basic building block of membrane. Right? So that's important. To build membranes. All membranes are made from phospholipids. Right. It can interconvert amino acids into sugar and proteins into sugar and fat for storage. And it can detoxify ammonia and turn it into urea. Ammonia is highly toxic in our bodies, especially our nervous system. Urea is not so toxic, and better yet, the kidneys are able to excrete urea, and they almost can't secrete any ammonia whatsoever. Right? So the liver has an important function that way. And it also produces clotting factors so that you have proper coagulation function so you don't bleed. All right. There is a compound, adult beverage, which is ethanol. Ethanol is converted to fat in the liver. Right? That's another conversion. It detoxifies alcohol by converting it to a fat. And that's pretty much the only fate for alcohol, is being converted into fat. So when you sit down and have a glass of wine or some whiskey or a beer, right, and you drink alcohol, what is it like eating? It's like eating a bar of butter, right? Because it can only be turned into fat in your body. Right? So it's highly caloric. And not only that, that fat has a tendency to build up in the liver. And that condition can be dangerous because it can lead to other conditions. Not only the buildup of fat decreases the function of the liver, all that normal function, right? And it's called a fatty liver, but a fatty liver can lead to cirrhosis, liver cirrhosis. Liver cirrhosis means that there's hardly any function left to the liver, and liver cirrhosis leads very commonly to liver cancer. Right? So all of those things are important to consider. All right, well, lastly, I think I just want to reemphasize, if anybody has family history of colon cancer, right, don't put off getting that colorectal screening, because that certainly can save your life. Okay. All right. Any questions about the digestive tract? Oh, I have a question for you then. Let me go back to that large intestine. Where's that large intestine? Ah, here's a large intestine. Okay. Well, we can break down food stuffs into three major kinds of compounds. Proteins, you know, the building block of a protein, those are amino acids. Sugars, building block would be glucose, right? And lipids, or fats. So we got proteins, sugars, and fats are the three major kinds of nutrients that we have in our body. And of those three, if we were to take the same amount of weight and find out how much energy is in each of those three compounds, we would see that lipids have more than twice the available energy compared to the other two. So the same amount of fat, right, gives you twice the caloric input compared to glucose, right, or sugars and proteins. So a lot of people like to restrict their fat intake because they want to control their weight because it is so highly caloric. Somebody came up with a really good idea. They found a compound that blocks absorption of lipids in the small intestine, right? So that those lipids stay in the small intestine, they don't enter your body. Well, what might be some of the consequences of that? If they don't get absorbed by the small intestine, where do they go? Right into the large intestine. And these are nutrients, and guess what can take advantage of all those nutrients? All those billions of bacteria that normally live in the large intestine, they'll be very thankful for all that energy, right? And they will irritate and inflame the large intestine, increase the motility, and produce a malabsorption syndrome, which is characterized by, what, copious amounts of watery stool. But because it's oil that enters the large intestine, it's not only watery stool, it's oily watery stool, which is almost impossible to contain with this external anal sphincter. So when somebody's on that agent, it's called Xenical, then they have no idea when they're stooling themselves with that kind of nasty mixture. So I don't know why anybody would actually elect to take that kind of drug. Right? So anyway, so whenever diarrhea is produced by some kind of agent, some kind of pharmaceutical agent that might be a side effect, you can pretty much guess that that agent is blocking the absorption of some nutrient in the small intestine and it's getting into the large intestine and it's producing that malabsorption syndrome, okay, which is not good because you lose water and electrolytes when that happens. All right, so that's pretty much it for the digestive system. Anybody have any questions on digestive system? You got your exam figures, all of that kind of stuff? Okay. I'll put digestive system away. And move on to urinary system. When we look at gross anatomy of the urinary system, we're going to see that it's really simple. There's only four organs, right? And the four organs are kidneys, ureters, urinary bladder, and urethra. And here we see it, right? I see the two kidneys located bilaterally. It kind of looks like they're in the abdominal cavity, but they're not. They're actually behind the peritoneal membrane, and I have another slide where I show you that. So sometimes we say the kidneys are retroperitoneal, which means behind the abdominal cavity. Retro means behind. All right, so kidneys are the first organ, and then you have the ureters, which take urine from the kidneys and deliver it to the urinary bladder. Their urine is stored until there is a proper time to void, and then urine leaves the bladder via the urethra. So those are the four organs: kidney, ureter, urinary bladder, right, and urethra. So notice, when we label, okay, when we label this right here, you should say urinary bladder. Just don't say bladder, because that's ambiguous, because that could mean something else. What could that mean if we just say bladder? Like gallbladder, for instance, right? So when you talk about the gallbladder, you got to say gallbladder, because somebody might think you're talking about the urinary bladder, and vice versa. All right, so two words when it comes to talking about a bladder. I see renal arteries, I see renal veins going back to the inferior vena cava. So it's hooked up with just a typical kind of circulation. But there's a special circulation inside the kidney that we're going to look at. All right, so what are the functions of the kidney? It removes waste products from the blood. I think we all probably are aware of that, like urea, for instance, which is fairly toxic. And it helps regulation of water balance in your body. And when water balance is adjusted, that controls your blood volume. And the blood volume is very important for regulating blood pressure. Just the volume of blood will be directly related to blood pressure. So if your blood volume goes up, what happens to blood pressure? It goes up as well, right? So the kidneys help regulate your blood pressure. One way to think of that, all right, is your car tire. If you have a car tire and you put air into it, what happens to the pressure? Does it go up or does it go down? It goes up. Same thing for your cardiovascular system. If you put water in, the pressure goes up for a number of different reasons. So you're going to look forward to that in a physiology class. All right, the kidney also regulates electrolyte levels, right? L-Y-T-E. What's an electrolyte? Can somebody give me an example of an electrolyte? Electrolyte, what the heck is an electrolyte? It's a compound that has an electrical charge on it. That's why we call it an electrolyte. And some of these compounds, we don't do much in chemistry in this class. Some of those compounds are sodium, potassium, chloride, magnesium, iron. All of those things have an electrical charge on them, and hence we call these electrolytes. So all of those particles adjust the electrical properties of our body, like nerve conduction and muscle contraction. All right, the kidneys also regulate pH. And what is pH a measure of? It's a measure of acidity. Yeah, it's how acidic a solution will be. And it's just a simple number between 1 and 14. And if it's right smack in the middle, number 7, it means that that solution is neutral. But here's the funny thing. As a solution becomes more acidic, the pH number decreases. So from 7 to 6 is an acidic change. And if something has a pH of 1, that's what? Very, very, very acidic. All right, so just remember, as acidity goes up, what happens to the pH number? It goes down, and that's just because of the algebraic equation we want to use to just talk about pH. And then, lastly right here, the kidneys control red blood cell production because they secrete a compound called erythropoietin. Erythropoietin goes to red bone marrow and it causes red bone marrow to proliferate and produce red blood cells. So the kidneys monitor oxygen in our blood, and when it starts to decrease, Right? It sends that signal, erythropoietin, to red bone marrow to make more red blood cells so that our oxygen concentration increases. So not only does the kidney produce urine, but it is also an endocrine gland because erythropoietin is secreted by the kidneys, goes into the blood, travels everywhere, and especially to that distant location, red bone marrow, where it changes the function of that red bone marrow, causing it to make more red blood cells. Right, so the kidneys, kind of a strange function, it's act like an endocrine gland. All right, let's show you this diagram. All right, so here's a nice transverse section. And this is in the thoracic region that we see right through here. That's about the level of where your kidneys are. Your kidneys are about as big as your fists. They're located tightly arranged right up against your back muscles, surrounded by some perirenal fat, right? And that acts as a shock absorber so that the kidneys don't experience trauma quite so readily, right? And then anterior to the kidneys, we see the true abdominal cavity or peritoneal cavity. And remember, the peritoneal cavity is not open to the outside world, so it's lined by a special kind of membrane. What kind of membrane lines a cavity that's not open to the outside world? A serous membrane. Right, so here is the serous membrane, which we call the peritoneal membrane. All abdominal organs are in this region. They're removed on this particular slide. And notice that the kidneys are on the other side of that membrane. They're behind the peritoneal membrane, and that's why we call them retroperitoneal. Retro just means behind. All right, let me know if you have a question about that. All right, so here is, let's take a kidney out and slice it open. This is sort of like a coronal section of a kidney. We're splitting it in half. And we see that there are two major parts to the kidney. There is a superficial part and a deep part. And you know what a superficial part of any organ is called. The cortex. So this is the renal cortex, and the deep part of any organ is called the medulla. So here's the renal medulla, and you see it has some different structures. Let's just look at the renal medulla first. I see some triangular shaped structures. We call these pyramids, and these contain some major components of a nephron. A nephron is something that produces urine for us and does all those other things in the process of regulating blood pressure by regulating urine volume and electrolyte volume. That's done in these pyramids. And then there are separations between the pyramids, which are more linear. These are what we call columns. All right, so the medulla consists of pyramid, column, pyramid, column, pyramid, column, and all the way around to the other side. Here is the tip of a renal pyramid. This is where urine from this whole pyramid is going to be secreted into this collecting basin in this area here. That's called a calyx. And a calyx that's attached to one pyramid is called a minor calyx. So here's a minor calyx, here's a minor calyx. What do we got right here? What do we got right here? I just see one pyramid. Another minor calyx. And what do we got right here? A minor calyx, a minor calyx, a minor calyx. Do you kind of see where those things are located? Right, and the minor calyces then join together, like right over here. This is a calyx as well, but it's not a minor because it has contributions from many minor calyces. So this is what we call a major calyx. Here's a major calyx, here's a major calyx. And what kind of fluid is in a major calyx? It's going to be urine, right? It's going to be urine produced by nephrons, right, that are partly in the cortex and partly in the medulla, this pyramid right here. All right, once urine is in a major calyx, then it enters this funnel-shaped structure, and that's what we call the pelvis, renal pelvis. That helps funnel urine into this tube that takes it to the urinary bladder, and that tube is called the ureter, right? A little bit different than urethra. Where do you find the urethra at? What organ is the urethra attached to? The urinary bladder, right? And on the other end, it's not attached to anything, right? Just the outside of your body. We call that the urethral orifice. All right, so that's some things about the kidney. We got columns and pyramids, the cortex and the medulla, these calyces. This area of the kidney, right here that I'm circling, is called the hilum, or the hilus of the kidney. And the hilum of any organ or even other object, like maybe a seed, for instance, that region where it's attached to the rest of your body is called the hilum. So the renal hilum has the renal artery going in, the renal vein coming out, the ureter going out, and also the renal nerves are going in and out, just in this location. I don't see any access to the kidney in any other location except this one location, and that's why we call it a hilum, just this one area right here. All right, so that's pretty good for all of the major structures inside a kidney. It looks like that's an exam figure someplace. All right, and we want to know about the vascular supply of the kidneys. The kidneys are highly metabolic. They use up about 20% of all the energy used in our body every day. Even though they're pretty small organs, they receive about 20% of all the blood that your heart pumps. All right, so we want to make sure we understand the vascular supply, because the kidneys are very susceptible, right, to low oxygen concentration, because they need that oxygen to make ATP. All right, so how does blood get in the kidney? Well, via the renal artery, it enters at the hilum, and then there's a bifurcation, right, and these bifurcations take arteries to the columns, like right through here. So at that first bifurcation, they become segmental arteries. When they bifurcate once again, when they go between the pyramids, we call those interlobar arteries, because some people consider pyramids a lobe of the kidney. And I suppose that's okay. Right, so interlobar. Then when the artery reaches this junction right between the cortex and the medulla, these are what we call arcuate vessels, both veins and arteries, because they kind of what? Arch over the base of a pyramid. Arcuate. And then from the arcuate arteries, I see some arteries poking up directly into the cortex, right? Like rays of light shooting up. And so these are called the cortical radiate arteries, cortical radiate. So the sequence that you should know is you have renal artery, segmental, interlobar, arcuate, right? And then cortical radiate. Which of these arteries right here is at the intersection or the junction between the cortex and the medulla? Which one? Which one is right at that junction, right between the cortex and the medulla? I see it right here. The arcuate. That's right. So superficial to the arcuate is the cortex. Deep to the arcuate is the medulla. Right, so that's a nice line of demarcation that's easy to see. Right, when blood returns from the kidney, right, we have an arcuate, well, you have cortical radiate vein, arcuate vein, right, interlobar vein, and we really don't have segmental veins. The interlobar veins anastomose and form the renal vein. So that's just a little difference compared to the arterial system. All right, so that's the blood supply. So you should probably know the order of these things once you study the kidney a little bit. I don't think that will be too difficult to see. All right, and that kind of takes us to that's a structural and functional unit of urine formation. And that is what we call a nephron. Let's see if I have an illustration of a nephron. I do. And it's really complicated looking. But let's talk about this just a little bit in general. All right, so here I see the separation between the cortex, which is up here, and the medulla, which is down over here. So you know what these vessels are called. The arcuate, artery and arcuate vein, and it's systemic circulation. So the red one is the artery, the blue one is the vein. All right, so these structures here, these are nephrons, right? And we see that there is two different kinds, or there are two different kinds. There's one that's mostly located in the cortex. There's another kind that is partly located in the cortex, but there is a long segment that goes way down deep into the medulla. And since they have different structures, guess what? They have different functions as well. Okay, the ones that are mostly in the cortex are called cortical nephrons. These are working all the time, producing urine and adjusting how much urine is produced, how salty it is, depending on your intake of salt and water. But the juxtamedullary ones, the ones that are partly in the cortex and a major part is in the medulla, right? These have a special function. These are able to concentrate urine. These are special that conserve water so that you don't lose too much water when your water balance goes negative, right? So it can secrete a lot of toxic compounds into a very small volume of urine. That's the job of the juxtamedullary nephron. It has some special blood vessels around these loops. We call it the vasa recta. Vasa recta we find around the juxtamedullary nephrons, not the cortical nephrons. And the vasa recta helps concentrate urine, so it's very, very, very salty, so that you save as much water in your body as possible. All right, well, I think I want to talk about the nephron, and your study guide has a more reasonable illustration of a nephron. These are these illustrations here are difficult to understand, so, and a nephron really is not very hard to understand. So let's talk about a nephron and maybe draw it out so that we can see it. And as a matter of fact, this drawing of a nephron is going to be an extra credit quiz sometime between now and the end of the semester. If you can draw it and label it, right? So let's list the things that you want to draw out. If you think of a nephron, you can break it down into two regions, two compartments. These are, and both compartments have a fluid inside of them, so they're both kind of like tubes. The first compartment, all right, number one over here, we're going to call these tubular elements. And tubular elements contain a fluid we call filtrate, which is the precursor to urine. All right, so we call that filtrate. And that filtrate is going to be converted into urine before it's excreted. All right, so here is the first tubular element. It's called Bowman's capsule. The next one, fluid is going to move from Bowman's capsule into a tube that has a lot of twists and turns to it. What do we call something that is has all these twists and turns? Convoluted, yeah. And since this is the one closest to Bowman's capsule, we call this the proximal convoluted tubule. And remember, some of those tubes, did you see, drop way down into the medulla and then come back up to the cortex? That's what we call a loop of Henle. And so the next thing is going to be the descending loop of Henle. And then this filtrate is going to go back up to the cortex, so there's got to be an ascending loop of Henle. All right, so what kind of fluid is in this ascending loop? What fluid is in the descending loop? What fluid is in the proximal convoluted tubule? You got it right. It's filtrate, right? Okay. Ascending loop of Henle, and then it goes into another tube that has a lot of twists and turns. So what would you call that one? This one is far away from Bowman's capsule. Distal convoluted tubule. And then it's almost urine, right? It's still filtrate in the distal convoluted tubule, but that fluid now moves into something we call the collecting duct. And the collecting duct has urine in it. So filtrate is processed to become urine through all of these different tubes, but there has to be an interaction with some other components that we call, number two, vascular elements. What kind of fluid is in a vascular element? Blood. All right, so I'm just going to put blood right here. So what are the vascular elements? There's a capillary in the nephron. What kind of blood vessel brings blood to a capillary? Artery? Arteries are really big. How about a little artery? What do we call a little artery? Arteriole. Yeah, so that's the first one, an arteriole, and it's bringing blood into the nephron. So if it's bringing blood in, would that be afferent or efferent? That would be afferent, right? So that's the afferent arteriole. And an arteriole always brings blood into a capillary. This capillary is very special. You're going to see that it's very leaky. And it's got a special name. It's called the glomerulus. That's a capillary. I'll put it in parentheses, capillary. And I'm going to put a number one right there just for fun. All right, so we got to practice pronouncing this because you might have to spell this sometime. So this is glomerulus. Glomerulus. All right, so let's all say it together. It's glomerulus. And if you put it all together, it is glomerulus. Does that sort of make sense? That's exactly how it's spelled. All right, so that's a capillary. And what's the function of a capillary? Exchange. So this is where plasma leaks out of the blood and into Bowman's capsule. And when that plasma leaks out into Bowman's capsule, it becomes filtrate. Okay. All right. But not all the blood becomes filtrate. Some of it leaves the glomerulus and it goes into another arteriole. And this one is leaving the glomerulus and Bowman's capsule. Right, and so this is the efferent arteriole, which is a little bit strange because usually after a capillary, where does blood go? To a venule and then a vein and back to the heart. Usually there's only one capillary bed, but not in the nephron. Right, because we know that an arteriole always brings blood to a capillary. So there's a second capillary in the nephron, and we're going to call these the peritubular capillaries. What does peri mean? Surrounding. Peritubular, so these capillaries surround tubes, like these tubes up over here. Peritubular capillaries. And so these are number two. Number one is glomerulus. Number two are the peritubular capillaries interconnected with this efferent arteriole. And we've seen this kind of circulation rarely, but we've seen it twice. Between the hypothalamus and anterior pituitary, between the stomach and the liver. Okay? And those blood vessels that connect those two capillary beds, anybody remember what those are called? Portal blood vessel, right? Like the hepatic portal system. The hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal blood vessel between the capillaries and the hypothalamus and the pituitary. And it's a special door-to-door delivery system. That's what that portal system is. And then after these capillaries, where does blood usually flow into? A tiny, tiny little vein, right? Venial. So that's the last one. All right, so just like mitosis, I wanted you to know the order of various words. I would like for you to know the order of these different structures if you're going to trace a drop of filtrate through them or a drop of blood through the vascular elements. Right, so you should know this order because you're going to use that order to draw the diagram. All right, so we could start with tubular elements first or vascular elements. Some people might draw them both together, but I like to do one and then do the other. I think that's the simplest way for me to do that. So let's just start with number one, tubular elements. What's the first thing we want to draw out? Bowman's capsule. Bowman's capsule is kind of spherical, kind of looks like that. That's just in one dimension. All right, so there is filtrate that ends up in Bowman's capsule. That's that fluid. And then filtrate is going to move from, let me label it, BC, Bowman's capsule. Where is filtrate going to move from BC? What's next? The proximal convoluted tubule, PCT, and then where? Descending loop of Henle, and then back up, ascending loop of Henle. Another thing, the next one is the distal convoluted tubule, and then it goes into the collecting duct. What's in the collecting duct? Urine. All right, so what did we just draw on the board? What part of the nephron? Yeah, tubular elements, okay? Did you catch up to me? So far, so good? I don't know, you're laughing. I don't know why you're laughing. Does it seem like really complicated or what? No? Okay. Okay. All right, so those are the tubular elements. So now what do we want to draw? Vascular elements. All right, so here's a blood vessel bringing blood into the nephron, like so. That is afferent arteriole. The leaky capillary inside Bowman's capsule is right here. Yeah, that's the glomerulus. I'll just write it right down over there. All right, so this is a continuous blood vessel. It's not broken, so blood that goes in goes through this capillary and then comes back out. And so this is the arteriole which blood leaves, so that is the efferent arteriole. And an arteriole always brings blood to a capillary. So there's one more capillary left that we have to draw. How you doing? Got a question?
Oh, okay.
You're okay? Okay. So this blood then enters another capillary that surrounds everything. Right? Just surrounds everything. And so this capillary that surrounds all these tubes are the peritubular capillaries. PC. And then here would be the venule. Venule to vein, vein back to the heart, right? Because that's the definition of a vein. All right, so this is the structural and functional unit of urine formation, which we want to call what? What is the structure? Okay, what's the structural and functional unit of life? Cell. Structural and functional unit of communication between cells. The synapse. Structural and functional unit of contraction. The sarcomere. The structural and functional unit of urine formation is nephron, right? So now you know all the pieces. So let's jot that down. Somebody might ask you that sometime, like maybe even me, nephron. Structural and functional unit of urine formation inside the kidney is this thing over here. All right, well, you're probably interested to know, right, that there's filtrate in Bowman's capsule. How does it become urine? So we're going to answer that right now. How does that fluid become urine? All right, so we have plasma. I'm just going to use this black marker, I think. So we have plasma that's in the blood. That's the fluid inside the blood. And it leaks through those capillaries into Bowman's capsule. Based on the size of molecules. Large molecules can't get through the capillary, but small ones can. And you've probably done something like that this morning when you made coffee or tea or something like that. What is that process called? When you put a whole bunch of junk, right, behind a filter and only small particles can go through into the drink you want to drink. That is filtration, right? So this process right here, I'm going to just label it number one and put it over here. Number one is filtration. We'll look at the anatomy of why that happens in just a second. All right, so how does material move from filtrate to blood or blood to filtrate for filtration? Can you see that? I have a dot and an arrow. That's supposed to be an arrow right there. The dot is on the glomerulus. The arrow is pointing into Bowman's capsule. So that fluid, right, goes from blood to filtrate. That's filtration, that produces filtrate, based on the size of molecules. All right, so everything that's in plasma, if it's small enough, can leak out into Bowman's capsule, and if nothing is done, where does it go? Into urine, and you excrete it from your body. Some of the molecules that are really small are glucose, for instance. That's an important metabolite. You don't want to get rid of any glucose in your body whatsoever. You want to use it to make ATP. If you lose glucose in your body, that would be like going to the gas station, filling your gas tank up with gas, and then taking an ice pick and putting a hole in your gas tank. Right? It would be a big waste. Right? And that's really hard on your body to do that. So a lot of water leaks out, which you don't want to lose. Some you want to make urine, but just the right amount. Some glucose goes out, which is what you want to keep in your body. And there are salts and acids, everything else, urea, toxic compounds, filter out into the filtrate. All right, so as these tubes, the tubular elements are surrounded by the peritubular capillaries, right? So the black we have filtrate, which includes glucose. So I'm going to put a dot right here on that proximal convoluted tubule, and I'm going to put the arrow to what? That capillary, right? This process, and I'm going to label this number 2. Here's number 2. That is what we call tubular resorption. So what is resorbed? Water. Sugar. I'll put glucose. And in the normal person, we're going to say all glucose. Every single molecule of glucose is taken back. And where does it go? How does it go? Filtration is blood to filtrate. Tubular reabsorption is filtrate to blood. The opposite way. All right, one last thing. In filtration, good things and bad things leave your blood. The good things are brought back in by process number 2. But not all bad things that enter the glomerulus get filtered. There's still some urea that makes it into the efferent arteriole and maybe some other compounds that your body finds to be toxic. So the nephron has the ability to reach in and grab those toxic compounds from the blood and put it in a tubular element. So let's draw that in. So I'm going to put another dot on a blood vessel and draw the arrow to that loop of Henle, and we're going to call this number 3, just like that. So number 3 is what we call tubular secretion. Tubular secretion. Because once it's put into the tube, where does it end up? In urine and out of your body. So that is secretion or excretion. And you know what? Those are the three processes of the nephron that produce urine. The first one is filtration. Second one is tubular resorption of good things that you don't want to get rid of. And then the third one, tubular secretion, when you have toxic compounds or other compounds your body doesn't need and they're secreted into a tubular element. Okay? Those three processes. So that's really not too bad. That's pretty much everything about the nephron. All right, so do you think you'll be able to draw that in lab? What about this morning's lab? Were you able to do it, this morning's lab? Yeah, I think everybody did a good job with that. Okay, so what's the structural and functional unit of urine formation? That nephron is it, right? The nephron is it. All right, and if you look closely at your textbook, you'll see that it has all of those components. Right, but it's just way too artistic a diagram to see it clearly. All right, because here is Bowman's capsule. Here is the proximal convoluted tubule, all these twists and turns, and then it comes over here, right, the descending loop of Henle, ascending loop of Henle, and then what is this squiggly line here? Distal convoluted tubule, and then that goes into the collecting duct, which is right here. The blood vessels. From the cortical radiate artery, you have the afferent arteriole bringing blood into glomerulus, the first capillary, leaving via the efferent arteriole, and then I see all of the peritubular capillaries, and then here's the venule. So it's all right there, but it's just a little bit more complicated. Okay. This juxtamedullary nephron is special because it can concentrate urine. So it can secrete very small amounts of urine that are very salty. And these blood vessels that surround the loop of Henle, even though they're peritubular capillaries, they're special. We call these the vasa recta. Vasa recta are these special capillaries in the medulla, right, that surround the loop of Henle for concentrating urine. Special kinds of blood vessels. Vasa recta. That reminds me of something else. Vasa recta. That reminds me, you know, some blood vessels, arteries, are so big and so thick that they need their own blood supply. blood that's in the lumen of that blood vessel isn't close enough to all the cells that make up the blood vessel, so blood vessels have to grow into the blood vessel itself. And those blood vessels have a special name. Anybody look up? It's in the study guide. What do we call those blood vessels that actually bring blood inside the walls of another blood vessel because they're thick and muscular? This kind of reminds me of it. Vasa vasorum. Vasa vasorum are the capillaries or the vascular supply inside the walls of arteries inside your body because they're big and thick, right? Big, large arteries have vasa vasorum. All right, so vasa vasorum and vasa recta, right, kind of sound the same. Okay, let me look at the nephron and see what I need to talk about. We got vascular elements. Okay, we're doing pretty good. Let's look at the glomerulus inside Bowman's capsule and see why it's so special. So let me put this down over here. And okay, here are those three processes, right? Fluid from glomerulus into Bowman's capsule, filtration based on size of the molecule. Stuff in this tubule that your body shouldn't lose, number two, is tubular resorption. Other harmful compounds that didn't get filtered can be put into filtrate. And number three is tubular secretion. So here's a pretty nice slide that shows it. Not nearly as good as my diagram on the board, but that's okay. All right, so here is, right, the afferent arteriole entering Bowman's capsule. Here's the efferent leaving, and inside is that special leaky capillary that we call glomerulus. And when I look at Bowman's capsule, I see that here is the wall of this particular tube, and it bends around and then starts to lie on top of the glomerulus. And so this reminds me of a special kind of membrane. A membrane that is not open to the outside world. What do we call a membrane that's not open to the outside world? Serous membrane. How many parts does it have? It's got three parts, right? And the three parts are the visceral division, the parietal division, and the space between those two membranes, right? All right, so that's how we actually think about Bowman's capsule as well. The cells that are right on top of the glomerulus, we're going to call this the visceral layer of Bowman's capsule, right? Because it's touching the organ. Then we have that space, right? And then here is the part of the membrane that is not touching that visceral organ. So this is the parietal part of Bowman's capsule. So we got parietal, right? And then we have the space, and then we have the visceral division of Bowman's capsule right on the surface of these capillaries. Notice that the visceral division has funny looking cells. It has a lot of spaces between the cells, which makes them very, very leaky. So, and these things right here with all of these processes sticking off, which have even smaller processes on them, somebody called these things podocytes because it reminded somebody of feet. All right, I don't know if I see it, but that's a podocyte. All right, so here is the capillary. And what do you know about a capillary? How many layers make up a capillary? Just one layer, right? Just the endothelium. And there's squamous cells, and it's just a simple layer, a simple squamous epithelium. And these particular cells of the glomerulus have these big pores in them called fenestrations. So this is not a continuous capillary. This is what we call a fenestrated capillary. And it is more leaky than a continuous. And so small molecules can leak out between these foot processes and enter Bowman's capsule. All right, so here's a nice electron micrograph that shows the podocytes. And here is an illustration of how material moves. All right, so here's plasma. Water molecules and other dissolved materials can leak through the fenestrations very easily because there's high pressure inside the glomerulus, and then it diffuses through, right? So this is the endothelial membrane with these holes in it, so material can leak out very easily. Here is just a little very thin basement membrane, and the basement membrane just attaches the endothelium to these podocytes, and the podocytes have these big holes in them that we call filtration slits. Right? And so the process of material going from blood into Bowman's capsule or filtrate is called filtration. Right? And filtration is the process that produces filtrate because the glomerulus is very, very leaky. Right? So good things and bad things get filtered. But all the good things get resorbed. And if there's a bad thing that doesn't get filtered, there's a chance that it can be secreted someplace along the nephron later on. All right, so that is the glomerulus. And this, I didn't tell you. This thing right here is what we call the filtration membrane. So what are the parts of the filtration membrane? You've got the endothelium, you've got a basement membrane, and then you have the podocytes. Right? Podocyte foot processes, yeah, capillary endothelium with fenestrations, which makes it really leaky, basement membrane, podocyte foot processes of the glomerular capsule. That's the filtration membrane. These are very delicate structures. When somebody has nephritis, which is infection of the kidney, or other kinds of renal diseases, then the size of these pores change, right? And you might actually get red blood cells sneaking through here. And in that case, then you're going to have blood in the urine. That's not a good thing, right? And if the shape of these fenestrations and slit processes change, then the function of filtration is going to be disturbed, and the function of the nephron is going to be disturbed. So that would be a nephritis as well. And that's all important for maintaining blood pressure, which is really important in your body. Okay. So that's it. I think maybe on Wednesday, I'll talk about the juxtaglomerular apparatus. So the sign-in sheet is going around. And in lab, you're going to have an opportunity to come up and draw that nephron just like that if you want to before you take the quiz or the extra credit quiz if you want to. Anybody in class will be able to help you if you get stuck. So I recommend that everybody practice. Because if you have that, oh, you know what? The nephron is an exam figure, too. But if you have a picture of a nephron in your mind, guess what? The questions on the exam are going to be really easy, right? So that's what you should do. Memorize that nephron. A really good drag and drop exercise that I made for you in Blackboard. All right, that's it for lecture for today.